Does it say that it was you, a totally independent reporter, who broke all these stories, not the corporate media in Chicago?
I think it says that the code of silence extends to the media and our broader political culture.
Well, we're going to leave it there. I want to thank Paige May, co-founder of Asada's Daughters, and Jamie Calvin, founder of the Invisible Institute. That does it for the broadcast. I'll be speaking tonight around 7 in Madison, Wisconsin, at the Barrymore Theater, then on to Toronto, Canada, Thursday and Friday, then on Saturday in Troy, New York, at the Sanctuary for Independent Media, then to Philadelphia Free Library on Monday. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for evening news coming up next.
White Man Said Walk. The Teresa Raford Disorderly Conduct Trial Show airs Wednesday, May 18th, 7 to 8 p.m. Here's Prosecutor Lowe trying to question Ms. Raford.
It's probably more than fair to say that you are very upset by the fact that you were arrested, is that correct?
I'm not upset by the fact that I'm arrested. I'm a protester, so a lot of the reason that we protest is to communicate the inequities about what's happening. And the fact that I was arrested gives us that opportunity. Thank you.
That's White Man Said Walk, this Wednesday, 7 to 8 p.m. on KBOO, your community radio station.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Community College, inviting the public to meet finalists for the next PCC president. Forums held May 23rd through 27th at 4 campus locations. More online at pcc.edu/president-search. This program has also been made possible by Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. More information can be made by visiting gaypdx.com. And finally, this program is made possible by the Seattle Theater Group, presenting An Astrophysicist Goes to the Movies, two evenings with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, September 19th and 20th, at the Keller Auditorium. Tickets for Neil deGrasse Tyson this September go on sale this Friday, May 13th, and more information is available at portland5.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Here's an expert. Involved.
Coming up. Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, election results are in for the state of Oregon. Live in studio, we speak with former Seattle City Council member Nick Licata about his new book, Becoming a Citizen Activist, Stories, Strategies, and Advice for Our Changing World.
Also live in studio, we have Tim DeChristopher, Josh Fox, and Mia Reback from 350.org to talk about their campaign to break free from fossil fuels. I'm Theo Burke.
And I'm Jamie Haddad. 2016. In Oregon elections last night, Bernie Sanders wins, Nestle loses, Portland motorists will pay more for gas, and Novick faces a runoff election. Sanders defeated Hillary Clinton in Oregon's primary with 56% of the vote. Clinton led yesterday's Kentucky primary by half a percentage point. Locally, Ted Wheeler will be the new mayor, Amanda Fritz retains her city council seat, and Steve Novick will be in a runoff election against either Stuart Emmons or Chloe U. Daly. Portland residents approved a 4-year, 10-cent per gallon gas tax to be used for road improvements and related safety projects, such as bicycle lanes and pedestrian crossings. Hood River County gained national attention by passing a ballot measure that aims to curb commercial water bottling, defeating Nestle's efforts to set up shop in Cascade Locks. In statewide elections, Governor Kate Brown won 84% of the Democratic vote and will face off in November with Salem oncologist Brad Pierce. The state race for Secretary of State will have Republican Dennis Richardson against Democrat Brad Avakian. Multnomah County residents also approved a bond measure for the Oregon Historical Society. However, most school bond measures were defeated, including Mount Hood Community College and the Centennial and Molalla School Districts. And Oregon may have one fewer city, with a majority of Damascus residents voting to disincorporate.
With most election news in the fewest words, here's KBOO's Dan Raphael with some election haiku for the latest installment of Poetic Justice.
Five election haiku. Bernie wins, Bernie wins, Bernie wins. Hillary didn't even visit. Incumbent city councilors always win their primaries, except Steve Novick. How many plastic bottles will Nestle executives fill with their disappointed tears? 10 cents a gallon for better streets. I'm filling my tank in Clackamas. When the powerful and the media tell Bernie to quit, he says, "We're winning California." This is poetic justice.
Yesterday marked a huge victory for the advocates of Measure 1455, a referendum which would prevent any company from producing more than 1,000 gallons of bottled water per day. Voters in Hood River County have essentially created a massive roadblock for Nestle's current plans to open a water bottling facility in Cascade Locks. Earlier today, I spoke with Amy Harwood, the interim executive director of BARC, about what yesterday's vote means for the future.
It was an historic victory yesterday. It was a remarkable thing. It was so great to be out there celebrating with people.
What does this mean moving forward for Nestle, for the city council, and for the county?
Well, I think one of the things is it shows a clear outcome to Governor Brown, Oregon Water Resources Department, and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife that there's definite local opposition to Nestle and the future of bottled water in the gorge. And all of those people have the ability to finalize this and end this entire proposal. And so I think that that's one outcome that we know for certain. BARC has had active litigation against the state's process of exchanging the water rights, and likely Nestle will try to sue the county over this new law. So I think that we have an impending legal battle here about to begin, and I think that having this kind of support, this overwhelming landslide of support in the county, just makes every tactic possible much more strong from here on out.
You mentioned briefly that Nestle may sue the county. What would that look like exactly?
Well, they would basically be suing the county to say that it is not, that the new law is not in compliance with other state laws. And we had many attorneys looking at this before this ever came forward, and this is not a simple decision. I think there was a lot of people who looked at this and made sure that this was a solid ballot referendum.
Is there any way that the city council could still somehow overrule the popular vote?
Yeah, it's very unlikely that that could happen. I think also something to keep in mind is that there's a real sweet victory for ballot initiatives like this, where you see long-lasting movement building happening. And I think that some of the empowerment that's happening in Hood River County with the local folks who have been organizing this are going to be reverberating into the local politics out there and also statewide. And I think that we're going to see a very different Cascade Locks after this ballot referendum.
Any final thoughts?
I think just until Nestle closes up shop in the gorge, I know BARC and many of the other coalition partners are going to continue to be part of this remarkable work. It's been a really incredible 7 years of trying to stop this, and certainly right now we are in a defining moment for this entire campaign.
Thank you so much for speaking with us today, and have a great day.
Thank you.
For KBOO News, I'm Jamie Haddad.
As primary races in the Pacific Northwest move into the real election season, grassroots organizers around the region are mobilizing against fossil fuels. As KBOO News reported a few weeks ago, a series of activist trainings is rolling out in Oregon with the goal of turning out at least 1,000 protesters. Here live to speak with us in the studio tonight are Tim DeChristopher, Josh Fox, and Mia Reback. Welcome.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Tim was bitter number 70 who spent 2 years in jail for derailing a federal government oil and gas auction in 2008. He outbid oil companies for parcels around Arches and Canyonlands National Parks in Utah. Josh directed the Oscar-nominated documentary Gasland and a new documentary called How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change is playing tonight and tomorrow at 7 o'clock at Cinema 21 at Northwest 21st and Irving. and it features Tim, who is with us in the studio tonight.
And we'll be there tonight for a Q&A as well.
And we'll be there tonight for a Q&A as well. And Mia is a prominent grassroots activist locally with 350 PDX. Welcome again. Thanks for being here. First, can we get a report on the action last weekend in Anacortes, Washington?
Yeah, we had a great time last weekend. Over 2,000 people converged on Anacortes, Washington from around the region for 3 days of direct action targeting the Shell and Tesoro refineries on March Point. For 36 hours, over 150 people held a rail blockade, stopping all crude oil trains from entering or exiting the facility, followed up on Sunday with a 100-person sit-in and over 150 people taking direct action via kayaks.
Awesome. And can you take a moment to list similar efforts around the nation and around the world?
Yeah, Break Free from Fossil Fuels is an international effort with actions happening in 12 different countries. We saw over 30,000 people participating around the world, targeting some of the largest sources of carbon pollution and advocating for an immediate and just transition to renewable energy.
Okay. And I understand that the Break Free... Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, and you know, we saw similar actions specifically targeting oil trains and bomb trains with Break Free actions like what was happening in Albany. They also kept the rail line shut down there for a while, and some of those folks got arrested. We're also seeing them outside of just the Break Free campaign, but like Rising Tide up in Seattle has been blockading some trains there, and especially with all of the export terminals that are being proposed and trying to be built right now, that's raising the stakes with some of these blockades on the transportation side of things.
And I understand, at least for Break Free, this is a the Break Free Fossil Fuels movement is targeted this month as a kind of a bump up period of intensifying activism. Is that true? And can you give this the details globally?
Yeah, it's totally a call out for mass escalation of the climate movement. It's recognizing that we have very little time left to meet the goal of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, and recognizes that governments are not prepared and do not have the commitments to get us there, and people must fill that gap between rhetoric and reality.
And what we're seeing across the nation is people fighting fossil fuel infrastructure projects, whether that's through the Break Free actions or as these battles have raged for years and years on end. Pipelines crisscrossing all of America, natural gas and fracked gas power plants, fracked gas fields, onshore drilling, offshore drilling, tar sands development, mountaintop removal for coal. People are taking action all across America because the fossil fuel industry is actually expanding at the very moment where we need to move away from fossil fuels and convert to renewable energy.
Yeah, we're finding more and more and finding them cheaply. Can we take a minute to explain Mia's point about running out of time and what is this goal of lowering the Earth's temperature 1.5 Celsius? I remember Al Gore's movie, And the Inconvenient Truth, warned us to get our act together by 2014. And so what is the existing scientific consensus on timelines?
Well, we've already raised the Earth's temperature by 1 degree. A long time ago, that doesn't sound like so much, 1 degree Celsius. But, you know, it's gotten everything on the planet Earth that needs to stay frozen to start melting. We have enough greenhouse gases in the atmosphere now and heat trapped in the ocean to bring us to 1.5 degrees already. So we're on a trajectory to get to 1.5 degrees. That means we have to start to move away from fossil fuels immediately. No further fossil fuel expansion, no further new coal plants, no new gas plants. We have to start to make that transition to renewable energy immediately, because at 2 degrees warming, you start to bring about 30 to 50% of the species on the planet go extinct. 5 to 9 meters of sea level rise, increased drought, increased flooding, increased extreme weather events, the kind of nightmare and apocalyptic scenario that we think about when we talk about climate change. And we're so close to that edge, which is why I think all of us are stepping up our campaigns.
Yeah, that 1.5C target that suddenly came out in Paris, I think is really a false one, and it's meant to be a distraction so that rich countries can avoid paying the damages to the countries that are currently suffering the impacts of climate change. So it's kind of a way of saying, let's pretend like things are still going to be okay. But we've pretty much already committed to dramatically surpassing that 1.5C target, and under a kind of any reasonable or easily imaginable scenario, we've pretty much already passed the 2 degree target as well with what's already in the pipeline in terms of emissions.
Wow.
Which is what our film is about. And that's why we're on tour across America. We're doing what's called the Let Go and Love Tour to 100 cities for how to let go of the world and love all the things climate can't change, to 100 cities across America. We're on city, I think, 43 or something. And everywhere we've gone, people are fighting the fossil fuel industry. People are fighting, as we've seen these break free actions, but also, you know, the pipelines and the power plants that are expanding across America. But the film is very sobering in terms of explaining how we are in many ways, as Tim is saying, too late to meet these targets. And what does that mean for us as human beings? Yeah, what does it mean for us as communities?
Does this translate into like actual years, or is it just like saying the alarm bell's going off, folks?
Well,
I think it's a shift in the movement of just acting like emissions reductions on their own are going to get us where we need to go. And it's acknowledging that we need to be working towards adaptation as well. And I think part of the reason that we're seeing more escalated actions, more people taking real risks and putting themselves in vulnerable positions right now is that whether people are consciously acknowledging it or not, there's a lot of folks in the climate movement that are realizing that we're just going to have to start getting tougher. Like, you know, the kind of courage that it takes to sit in front of a bomb train is the kind of courage that we're going to need for our future anyway, because we're on track for serious hardship. So it's what we're seeing now, I think, is both efforts at mitigation of standing up to the fossil fuel industry and keeping fossil fuels in the ground, but it's also a kind of adaptation as well, where we're building the kind of trusting relationships and communities that we're going to need for the chaos that lies ahead.
No, because I mean, the truth is, when you're asked the question, well, where do I move when, you know, things really go wrong with climate change? The answer is anywhere there's a strong community. And what we're watching, those strong communities are being built by people like 350 PDX, by the activists on the ground, you know, in the grassroots capacity. And that's what why we're not depressed. We're fighting. We're not drowning. We're not drowning in the water. We're not drowning in our own emotions. We're saying we have to actually meet people, come out of doors, live life to the fullest. And what that means right now is living meaningfully and taking part in these types of actions to protect our humanity as we go forward into a very uncertain climate future.
Do you feel the movement is growing fast enough?
I think fast enough is a hard question. It's really hard kind of from a systems theory perspective to know when there's going to be a big shift. And in my time as an activist here in Portland for the last 6 years, it has grown tremendously. And to see the thousands of people pouring in, ready to put their bodies on the line and take that action is really inspiring, I think. And it gives me motivation to stick with this movement and keep going. We're seeing lots of political shifts happening in Portland and Oregon, where we had a city council that was pro a propane export terminal. They are now leading the charge on banning all fossil fuel infrastructure in the city of Portland, the first of its kind in this country. And it's these shifts that, you know, to me is, yes, this is fast enough, this is enough, but we have to keep going and we have to keep trying. And it's through our community organizing that we're building the relationships that we need to really weather the storm and to be there for each other during extreme climatic events.
And speaking of elections, Mia, Josh, and Tim, how has the election cycle impacted this issue? Are there candidates or parties that are making climate change an electoral issue?
Well, yeah, certainly. I think Bernie Sanders nationally has really shifted the political discourse around climate change. And certainly, you know, he's been one of the strongest climate-friendly politicians that we've had for a while. And he introduced things like the Keep It in the Ground Act and fossil fuel leasing on federal lands early on in the campaign, and has made that a key part of his platform. For me, the shift really happened after the Paris terrorist attacks last fall, when Bernie Sanders, a week or two beforehand, had said that climate change is our greatest national security threat. And then after the attacks, then there was another debate where the moderator from CNN or wherever kind of tried to ridicule him for that and said, well, do you still think that climate change is the biggest national security threat? And he said, yeah, absolutely, I still do. And he, you know, he didn't back down from it, and he explained why, and he held his ground. Whereas I think most of our Democratic politicians, like Obama and Hillary Clinton and people like that, would give some kind of wishy-washy answer to sway with the winds of what was considered politically reasonable at the time.
Not just wishy-washy answers, but this whole regime of democratic incrementalism has failed to protect us from fracking. It has failed to protect us from climate change. It has failed to protect us from the ravages of the big banks. And what we're seeing here is Hillary Clinton, a very, very clearly pro-fracking candidate. Not only is climate change a threat to civilization, but fracking infrastructure and fossil fuel infrastructure is a direct threat to the American way of life. You can't have America where you have 2 million more fracking wells, where you have 300 new frack gas power plants and hundreds of thousands of miles of frack gas pipelines. This is Hillary Clinton's plan for energy as we go into this election season, and it's simply unacceptable, and it has to be stopped. And I think that you have an actual viable alternative in a person like Bernie Sanders. Well, there's no real person like Bernie Sanders, but in Bernie Sanders, who is the only anti-fracking candidate, the only person who's actually informed by the science, and has come out for a ban on fracking.
And more so, what I think makes Bernie Sanders such an incredible candidate is he comes from a background of social movements and community organizing. And while he's a politician, he recognizes that social change has to happen outside of the political system as well. And to me, I think that's where we see him introducing legislation that really backs what the grassroots is doing. We saw that during the Shell No protest last summer when he introduced the Keep It in the Ground Act and is really matching what we do on the ground in office. And I think that is a direction that we need to see more political leaders that are part of our social movements, and that's how we're going to get the level of change that we need.
And what we're seeing, even with a lot of local and state candidates across the country, is a shift from understanding climate change just as an environmental issue and maybe, you know, throwing out some environmentally friendly talking points that they got from the NRDC or the World Wildlife Fund or something, and seeing folks with a really deeper understanding of the intersectionality between climate change and so many other social justice issues. And so we're seeing, you know, congressional candidates like Pramila Jayapal up in Washington, and folks like that that are making these connections between climate change and racial justice and poverty and a lot of different issues there.
Yeah, in fact, Goldman Sachs just was revealed as one of the biggest financiers of fracking. We also know that the top 10% worldwide is responsible for 50% of climate change emissions. And this is the type of discussion that we're having every night at the theater. It's been a remarkable experience, so we're encouraging people to come out and continue this conversation tonight at the Cinema 21.
And we want to give you a moment to talk. We're down to about 2 minutes.
Sure.
We want to let you talk about your film, Josh, but first, Mia, if you could tell us about Break Free from Fossil Fuels, where is it located, and does the organization have specific priorities?
Break Free from Fossil Fuels is a collaborative initiative, really, that is saying, you know, here in the Northwest, that we need to pivot from just stopping proposed new fossil fuel infrastructure to addressing what we currently have. People are invited to get involved in your community. Folks in Portland, visit 350pdx.org, sign up, join us, get involved in the movement here at home.
And Josh, tell us about your film, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climates Can't Change.
Well, it's a trip across the world. It goes to 6 continents, 12 countries, to meet some of the most inspiring, engaging climate fighters all across the planet. The film pulls no punches in terms of how desperate this situation is, and it sort of hits a wall at, you know, 100 miles an hour right in the middle and says, my God, there's no way out of a lot of this climate problem. But then it goes and I think is on an incredibly inspiring, emotional roller coaster journey through China to be with, you know, human rights fighters against environmental pollution in China, to Pacific climate warriors battling Australian coal, to indigenous environmental monitors in the Amazon. But the most important, and people in the Rockaways who rebuilt their communities with their own hands with the Occupy Sandy, and talking about the values structures that we need moving forward as we go into this climate crisis. And really the point of us being here, myself and Tim, and collaborating with 350PDX, is to have that community conversation every night at the theater. That's going to happen tonight. We're playing music there. We're playing music before and after the film. It's been a remarkable journey so far, so we want to have people come and join us.
Well, great. We really appreciate you coming down to the KBOO studios. It was really great to meet you. And this has been Mia Reback, Tim DeChristopher, and Josh Fox. Find out more about Breaking Free from Fossil Fuels at breakfree2016.org. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Day 8 of the United Methodist Church's General Conference in Portland began with a demonstration by the church's LGBTQI inclusion advocates, who silently greeted delegates at the front doors holding crosses draped with rainbow-colored stoles and signs saying, "It's time." The church's bishops tried to make peace and keep the church unified this morning ahead of a legislative session expected to be explosive and possibly split the church. KABU reporter Theo Burke was on the scene again at the Oregon Convention Center.
The United Methodist Church's World Council of Bishops issued proposals this morning designed to make peace in the church in response to an unprecedented resolution from the conference delegates yesterday that asked the bishops to please lead and not just preside. The church body feared it might explode today, with serious talk of splitting into more than one denomination. Resolutions promoting gay inclusion in the second largest Protestant Christian denomination had never made it out of committee. And several resolutions with potentially hurtful language and restrictions on LGBTQI people were expected to hit the floor today. The conference has been peppered with peaceful protests by the pro-inclusion Love Thy Neighbor Coalition and by a Black Lives Matter group of African-American Methodists. The bishops asked the conference to do four things to stay united. First, refer all the remaining proposals on human sexuality to a special commission to be appointed, while also considering a possible extra world conference in 2018 or 2019 to deal with this issue. Third, explore ways to avoid further defrocking trials of ministers who perform gay marriage ceremonies. And finally, the bishops asked the church to replace 2 hours of the conference session today with prayer and conversation rather than contentious legislation. Today we hear from two voices from the conference. First, Blair Barber from Oak Park, Illinois, whose daughter came out as a lesbian in high school. Blair is also a member of the Love Thy Neighbor Coalition here at the conference. And then we hear from the press conference of presiding bishop Bruce Oeg of Minnesota. I'm here with Blair Barber from Oak Park, Illinois. Hi, Blair.
Hi.
And your daughter, who is now 29, came out as a junior in high school. Can you tell us about how that all started?
She hit the high school and was on her planning to go to prom. She had an announcement to make to me that she was going to take a girl, and she was believed that she was a lesbian.
You're obviously here. Are you hopeful?
I am hopeful.
What do you think of the developments of the last 24 hours and the bishop's statement to defer this to a new committee and maybe an extra general conference and to pray instead of having legislation on the conference floor? I mean, do you feel like this is a good move, what they're saying, to take a breath, or do you feel that they're avoiding the issue? I mean, how do you feel about the last 24 hours?
I think it's really hopeful that they're slowing things down. There were going to be 56 pieces of legislation to be voted on today that I think are going to be tabled, and they were going to be very, there was some very unkind language toward LGBT people.
I will tell you that there is very honest, candid conversations going on, and I think a growing awareness within the entire council that we have to come together. We're quite frankly humbled. I mean, we began our deliberations yesterday afternoon in response to that in deep prayer, in recognition that the church has given us a kind of holy moment. And just to put it in the vernacular, we didn't want to blow it.
There's one group that cannot be at the table with full integrity. Yeah, under the current rules, how would you handle the openly gay or lesbian clergy and get their input?
This commission that we would form will be sure that all voices are present.
I'm Theo Burke for the KABU Evening News. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Up next is news from the Boo at 5:45. At 6 p.m., it's Pacific Underground with a special episode for Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. At 7, it's The Man Said Walk, a one-hour special covering the Teresa Rayford trial. Tomorrow's weather is looking rainy all day with possible thunderstorms here in Portland. East of the Cascades and Hood River, skies will be cloudy with a slight chance of showers all day. Today in history, Mount St. Helens erupted in 1980. That's right, May 18th, killing 57 folks and sending volcanic ash 80,000 feet into the air. The quote of the day comes from U.S. Forest Service scientist and Mount St. Helens researcher Peter Frenzen, who said about the eruption, "The biggest single lesson was an early one, and that was that what appeared to be a lifeless landscape was anything but."
Tonight's broadcast is a special focus on grassroots activism around our region and around the country. So we wanted to start out by defining the term activism and bringing in one of the country's leading experts on that, Seattle City Council member Nick Licata. The Nation magazine named Nick Progressive Municipal Official of the Year. His new book is Becoming a Citizen Activist, Stories, Strategies, and Advice for Changing Our World. Thanks for coming in, Nick.
Well, thank you for having me on KBOO.
Why did you decide not to run for re-election this year?
I love city politics. I really liked helping the people of Seattle basically improve their living conditions and working conditions. But I also was giving more and more thought to national issues and how important it was to actually work with other people to help them figure out how to push forward the issues they're working on in their communities. So I'm continuing to work not only in Seattle, but hopefully other cities as well.
What has that transition been like?
It's been very good. I've been working with a group called Local Progress that is about 4 or 5 years old now. It's about 400 to 500 progressive municipal officials around the country and forming a network. And basically, how do you spread the ability to pass good legislation like paid sick leave and increasing the minimum wage?
Seattle City Council is famous as one of the only, if not the only, socialist council member, Shama Sawant. Now there is also a majority of women on the council for the first time in modern memory. What is going on in Seattle politically? Is it more radical than other cities?
You know, I really resist that because I like to think that the people in Seattle, in fact, are very much like the people in any other city. But the difference is that our city government, over time, has become what I say more more porous. There's more portals. We have a number of citizen commissions that basically bring citizens into the process of helping shape legislation. And I think that has given them hope that they can, in fact, get something done. And so they become more involved. They become more active. So we've literally, I think, have raised our own population of activists within Seattle because we've nourished them.
How is your new book, Becoming a Citizen Activist, a guideline of sorts for that?
I really believe it's important to do basically street actions, doing protests, doing anything possible to stop an action or promote some sort of issue forward. But you also have to figure out what the best strategies are to move forward. And that includes making allies in government if possible, holding their feet to the fire, but viewing them as an asset. And so I go into some detail about how do you get laws passed with both activists on the outside and citizens who really want to do the right thing, but not quite sure how on the inside.
Why did you decide to write the book?
I decided to write the book because I asked myself, how is it that I became an activist? So part of it was self-reflective, and the other was recognizing that there are certain things that work and certain things that don't work. And it's really important, I think, as we get older in life, whatever, to share what we learn and also to continue listening. I haven't stopped listening to what other people have done. And so I'm hoping, for instance, for this website I've created, becomingacitizenactivist.org, to be able to bring in people's stories from around the country and share information.
It might seem obvious to some people, but Nick, what is activism today, and does Facebooking count?
Facebooking does count. you know, Twitter accounts, in fact, any of the social media accounts, but I would not ignore, you know, technology that's been around for a long time, newspapers, newsletters, postcards. You know, one of the simplest forms of activism. When I was running for office, I had an easy election, so I made these calling cards and I dropped them off in restaurants, which basically said, you have not protection from wage theft. The city council passed something. So every time we paid a bill, the worker there realized that there was a law protecting them and gave a phone number where they could file a complaint. So we have to be open to how to use the technology all around us to basically spread the word of what rights people have or what rights they should have.
What do you see as the best methods of activism that people should be picking up now?
The best methods?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think the best method actually is not to rely on any one particular method.
It's a good strategy.
No, really. I mean, I think that you have to evaluate what the situation is given your community, the community you're working in, what's the issue that is most focused. One thing you have to keep in mind, you can't do everything at once and you can't do it yourself. So the two fundamental rules of organizing, I believe, is focus and know who your allies are and bring them together and then do your homework, get the information out and just continue to work at it and enjoy it. If you don't enjoy it, you're not succeed.
What tips would you give for someone just starting out in activism? Say they take up a cause and they don't really know what to do next.
Well, you know, thanks to the internet, if they're interested in a particular issue, go to the internet and find out what groups are working in that area, both nationally and locally. Do searches on your local media to find out, has there been any activity in that area? You will find just about any topic and any city, there are people interested in doing something in that area. Seek them out, meet them, and say, look, I have X number of hours a week. I can do research, or I can do phone calling, or I can help you organize an event. And you will then find yourself part of something larger.
As a politician yourself, what do you see as the most effective movements you've had to deal with while in office?
I think the most effective ones have basically been brought together by what I'd say strong allies. Unions are a critical element, so are churches, and so are community groups. So we need to basically make sure that you have a wide base of institutional and individual help.
What are some of examples of those movements that have come through
Seattle?
Well,
we were able to get paid sick leave within a period of 8 months. And actually, paid sick leave in Seattle, when it passed, is one of the best in the nation. We were able to get $15 minimum wage per hour, one of the first in the nation to do that. And other cities are following in that path. But we did wage theft, and we're continuing to, the battle I was fighting before I left and continue to help others fight, is try to get our pension funds to divest from carbon fuels. I think that's a very critical element, particularly in light of the prior speakers who were on your program.
Yes.
Are there any secrets of organizing people for a mass movement that...
I don't think there's secrets per se, but I think there are certain sort of rules to keep in mind. One of them is don't talk over people. Listen to them first. Figure out what their concerns are. And then identify what their concerns are with your principles and what your objectives are. And when you link those together, you magnify your power.
My parents would always say you have two ears and one mouth.
Yes.
Nick, what is the stake? What is at stake right now in our world and in local communities that we should be organizing around?
Well, I think on the larger scale possible is certainly climate change. I've been to a number of actually very conservative conferences trying to figure out what they're saying. And all of their leadership are denying even the problem of climate change. So that is a battle that is still needs to be fought. But underlying that, one that is, I think, perhaps even more important, but one that is not really well-defined, is protecting our democracy, is getting people to understand that we do live in a democratic government. We have to make it democratic, and that means being responsive and accountable. And that's a battle that continues to, that must go on.
I understand that you're giving a talk tomorrow night at Powell's. Can you give us more details about that?
Yes. Well, I will be talking about the title of the book says it all. You know, how do you become a citizen activist? And I emphasize you don't have to be a superhero. You don't have to be dedicated to a cause the rest of your life. You basically have to be conscious of what your political, social environment is. Ask yourself, are you satisfied with it? And if you're not, how do you go about changing it? So I talk about basically what I call sort of the 7 steps to becoming more involved as a citizen that has some control over their own future. Because if you don't control your own future, someone else will.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Nick.
Thanks, Nick, for having me on your show.
That was Seattle City Council member Nick Licata. His new book is Becoming a Citizen Activist, Stories, Strategies, and Advice for Changing Our World. He speaks tomorrow night at Powell's on Hawthorne at 7:30 p.m.
President Obama has signed a rule change that will enable over 4 million Americans to qualify for overtime pay by the end of this year. Salaried employees earning less than $913 per week will be eligible for overtime pay on all hours in excess of 40 per week. The new rule will cover most private sector and government employees, but is expected to have its biggest impact in the retail and restaurant industries. The change is the first update to the salary guidelines since 2004 and will go into effect on December 1st. The new salary levels will be updated every 3 years. Based on wage growth projections, that means it could rise to $51,000 by the year 2020.
San Francisco Bay Area broadcast and print journalists are trying to tackle houselessness. Led by the San Francisco Chronicle, 30 news organizations are banding together to bring renewed attention to the houselessness crisis. The journalists believe that the problem is so long-standing that city government and local leaders have become complacent. Their hope is that by creating a wave of coverage, it'll force politicians to take action. The news outlets have agreed to publish their reports on June 29th.
Ecuadorians felt another earthquake on Wednesday, an aftershock from last month's quake, which killed over 600 people. The 6.8 magnitude quake struck in the morning, just 100 miles away from the capital of Quito. Coastal communities are still in recovery mode from the previous 7.8 quake back in April. Half of the hospital and healthcare facilities in the region are currently out of service due to the previous damage, and thousands of kids are still out of school or in temporary educational spaces.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032, extension 203. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jamie Haddad, Theo Burke, Dan Raphael, and Ray Bodewell. The producer is Jenna Yokoyama. Our engineer is David Kesters. KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jamie Haddad.
And I'm Theo Burke. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7 a.m., it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Voices from the Edge, guest host Paul Rowland talks with filmmaker Josh Fox, our guest tonight, who made Gasland and Gasland 2, and about the new film, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change, showing tonight at Cinema 21. As well, at 9 a.m., Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, on Fight the Empire, host Per Fegering speaks with journalist Peter Dolick about his recent article in Counterpunch, Could an Economic Collapse Be in Our Near Future? At 10 a.m., Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 a.m., on Between the Covers, host David Naiman interviews Brian Blanchfield about his book Proxies, Essays Near Knowing, a collection of 24 single-subject essays on a wide variety of topics. Thank you for listening to KBOO, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support.
Good night.
Good night, Jamie.
Good night, David. We'll be right back.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station. And now it's time for News from the Boo, our weekly program Wednesdays at 5:45, where we hear from folks inside of KBOO about happenings around our beautiful community radio station. My name is Monica Beamer, and I am the station manager at KBOO, and I get to interview Erin Yankee tonight, KBOO's program director and youth advocate. Hi.
Hi, Monica.
Thanks for coming.
Of course.
So most folks probably already know you, but